Morning. Let me ask a question before I start. How many people here haven't used Postgres before at all? And how many people here have used Postgres but haven't used Explain before? And how many people here have used Explain but couldn't figure out what it was trying to say? Okay. So just a bit of background for what Explain is. It's you can post when you give a query to Postgres, you're giving it an abstract idea of what set of records, what result set, what data you're looking for it to produce. Not an imperative instruction on how to produce, to go about producing that data. So Postgres has to go and figure out how to produce that data, and there are many different choices. So often you want to know how it's going about doing it so you can make sure, so you can explain why it's taking so long or figure out if there's a better way or if you need new indexes or all kinds of things. And it's a funny kind of command which you stick on the beginning of an existing command. So you have select star, blah, blah, blah. If you say explain select star, instead of running the query, it will spit out the explanation of how it was going to run the query if you actually issued it. It works for select, that's the most common case, but it also works for delete and update and even insert. Usually those queries are simple enough that there's nothing to really explain, but sometimes you can have a select statement inside your insert. You can have, Postgres allows an extension for delete that allows you to specify other tables to go and fetch. You can have subqueries in your delete anyways, but update, you can have an extension that allows you to fetch other tables to fetch some data. So sometimes they come up as well. This query comes from the TPCC benchmark. The query doesn't, but the schema does. These tables do. The join clauses are unfortunately a little bit more complicated than necessary because of the way the schema is laid out, but they're actually fairly straightforward. It's a join between seven tables, and it's just a simple join where each table depends on, so for example, we're getting a bunch of orders. For each order, we're looking up all the order lines, the items in those order lines, how much stock there is in each item, and so on and so on. Even a fairly simple query like this, when you run explain, sometimes you get overwhelmed with results like that. The problem with understanding, interpreting the explain results, I find, is usually not in the understanding any one piece of it. It's being overwhelmed with the sheer quantity of information. That was a fairly simple query to produce such a large plan. You can end up, we've seen plans on the mailing list with hundreds of steps, even sometimes more. The first question that arises is usually where do you start when you're looking at something like this? The interesting thing, I find it's usually simplest to think in terms of chronological order. The database isn't thinking about that. So the first thing in the list is actually the last thing that happens. It's giving you an idea of where it gets the data. It's getting it from a join of two other places and so on and so on. But those things don't depend on other things, and those things depend on other things. The first thing that happens is actually one of these things that are very deeply nested. Those produce results which feed up to the next level up, and so on until they produce the final result. So each of these things with an arrow is a bit of terminology, it's called a node. The whole thing forms a kind of tree, so each node can have several children, it'll have a parent right up until the first node, which is the parent of everything. Joins are always have two children. There are some other nodes that will have only one child. It all starts with some node deep inside, or multiple nodes deep inside that have no children, and they're going to be scanning your table and finding your data from some other source. And that data eventually filters its way up from parent to parent all the way to the top. There's another way of looking at this. There's a tool called pgAdmin, which Dave, who is over there, is a maintainer of, that has a visual representation. This is the same plan as that previous page. Could be, it's sometimes, depending on how you think about it, one tool or the other might be easier to understand. This shows the same information of all the information filtering up, joining together to produce the final result. Even the information, like how thick the lines are, exactly which icon, and there's mouse over information as well, was all on that. It's getting all of this information from that textual output from the previous page. But inside that information, this is the first half of it, because obviously it's too much for a slide. First thing to realize is all of the output of explain is not what actually happened when you ran your query, because it didn't run your query. This is only its guesses, its estimates of what's going on, what's going to happen. And it's all of the information that it's using, it's trying to give you information that it has on which it's made the decisions of which types of joins, which types of plan to use. So these rows are its estimate of how many rows will be processed by that node. So where it says here rows equals 100,000, it didn't actually process 100,000, that might not actually be accurate. In fact, it's perfectly accurate. That's how large the benchmark, that table is on this benchmark at this scale. But for example, you have things here. The way the benchmark is actually laid out, these two numbers should be the same, but it's just estimating approximate values. And there's more about that on another slide. Then there's the cost. And the cost, there are actually two cost values for each node. The cost is in an arbitrary unit. It's not a physical real-world unit. It can be, but it's not. Well, I'll get to that. The cost is what the planner uses to actually make its decision on whether it'll cost out two different ways of doing it, compare the costs, choose the cheapest plan. Cheapest, however, is a bit complicated because depending on how that node is used in other steps of the plan, it may be better to come up with the node that is the cheapest to produce the first record or to produce all the records. So it actually needs to keep track of two costs. And that's important to understand, especially if you're optimizing for OLTP systems versus data warehouses or systems where response time matters more than overall speed. You want to avoid queries like this one where to produce the first record is expected to take 22,000 somethings. And then it's going to take about the same amount of time to produce all the remaining records. But the reason it took so long to produce the first step is because somewhere along here, there is a sort. So it had to sort all of the records that it produced before that, just to produce, and of course when you sort something, you can't know what the first one is until you're finished sorting. So every step after that, that cost filters up the plan. Each cost is the cost to run that node of the plan, including all of the things under all of its children, which feed into it. So normally, with some exceptions, they'll be increasing in cumulative as they go up. The costs, this is what I meant about the units. By default, there are a bunch of parameters that configure how expensive Postgres will estimate various things that it has to do to produce your plan, to produce your records. By default, a sequential page access, that's the time to read 8K if it's reading the whole table, 8K one after the other, sequentially through the database. That's the fastest way to read data off a disk. by default, that's cost is 1.0. So all of the other costs are in terms of how long it's going to take to do a sequential page access. You could actually try and adjust that to try and make it actual milliseconds and then proportionally adjust all of the other parameters, and then your costs should, in theory, be in milliseconds. In reality, things aren't that, don't work out that nicely, and it's probably not worth bothering. But it could be an interesting experiment. One thing to realize is that random seeks through a table are very expensive. 4.0 is an estimate based on some empirical results. A lot of people find they have to reduce that number, not because their disks are especially fast at seeking, but because their database fits mostly in RAM, and so the database is overestimating how many random accesses are really necessary. It's a floating point number, so you can lower it to 3.5 or 2.5 or 1.1. Values below 1 don't make any sense. And then it also tries to add up how much time will be spent in CPU work as well. Yeah, God, I'm sorry, I hit those on the previous slide. The best way to understand when you think the query is not performing well is not just to be looking at the plan and guess and imposing your own judgment on whether it's made a good decision. It's to ask it to actually run the query, which is safer for select than update, delete, and so on. But ask it to actually run the query and then compare what its estimates were with what the database actually found when it ran the query, which you can do by running explain analyze. So explain analyze is usually, if you post on the mailing list, people will ask for explain analyze results because they don't trust that your database is making, they don't have enough information themselves to know whether the database is making the right decision, and just posting explain results doesn't give people enough information. So this is the top half of that. I've reformatted it slightly just so you realize. So normally each node has cost, rows, width, and then if you run explain analyze, this would be on the same line. The results get quite wide, so I have to put it on the second line. The first thing that jumps out at people on the list, if you post the information, and the first thing you should be looking at is the estimated number of rows that the planner estimated based on its statistics, and the actual number of rows that it found. And at each node, it's giving results. And in this case, they're not exactly right, but they're very, very close. Even results that are 10, 20, 50% off are very, very accurate for as far as planning goes. If it's 100%, like double the number or triple if it's estimating 10 records and it's finding 100 records, then it might make a bad decision and all hell breaks loose. If it's making a bad estimate of the number of rows, the rest of the everything after that is there's no point in worrying about whether you need new indexes or whether you need to change the cost parameters, because it's all based on faulty premise. So that's why that's the important thing to look at first. If it's got a reasonable estimate for the number of rows, then you can start looking at the cost and comparing it to the actual time spent. Now, if you've left sequential page scan at 1.0, which is generally what people do, then these won't be to the same scale. But they should be roughly proportional. I'm not sure if I'm going through too quickly or too slowly or too much depth. There are a lot of different types of nodes. Mostly they're pretty self-explanatory. But I've made slides for a lot of them anyway, so you can go through. Scans are the raw source of data. They're going to be scanning your table, using an index or scanning the raw data, or there's other ways to access it. They could be getting data from a function, because you can do select star from a function. They could be getting data from values clauses. If you do insert values, you can actually use values inside selects, which is very handy. They don't have any children, they just pull out data from some source. There are different ways of doing joins, and they have very different properties. And so choosing how to do the joins and in what order to do the joins is probably the most important decision in your plan that you want to understand what the planner is doing. Joins always have two children. So if you're joining three or four or five tables, the planner has to choose two to start with, and then add a third one joined with the result of that, and then take the fourth one and join it to the result of that. So it has to build up a binary tree of tables to do the joins. So the order in which it's paired them together makes a big difference. I guess I misspoke. It could also join one and two, join three and four, and then join those two results. So there's other ways of arranging it. Then there's a few other types of operations. In particular, they're interesting for partition tables, and that's one of the few types of plans that can have more than two children. You can have a partition table with 100 partitions. There are other set operations as well that are a bit less common. They can also have more than two children. And then there are plans which take an input and transform it in some way. Either sorting it, do aggregates to handle group by, limits, so on. So I have slides on each of these. Sequential scans are usually what you'll find the planner generating and what causes the most questions on the mailing list, because people are always asking, why isn't Postgres using my index? It's using a sequential scan. It sounds crazy to me to be sequential scanning my data when I have an index. The answer is because sequential scans are very fast. If you're going to read a significant amount of the table, it's probably faster to just scan the whole table than to just scan your section. People are usually surprised by how small a percentage significant can be. Sometimes, depending on how your data is laid out and how wide your records are and a host of other factors, 1% of your table could be faster to scan using a sequential scan of the whole table. Usually it's somewhat higher than that, but it can be surprisingly low. Sequential scans have other advantages. They produce the first record very quickly. They never have to read the same data twice. They never have to. There's a host of reasons why sequential scans are usually are often preferred, especially for queries that are processing a large amount of data. You usually don't want them on OLTP systems unless you have a tiny table, because it's just basically a sign that the query is not the right query for an OLTP system because it's processing too much data. Index scans. Postgres is capable of using index clauses that don't match the key exactly, especially if you have a prefix of a key. It's capable even if it's not a prefix. But usually, you do want to see what index condition it's actually using. And if it's not matching the index condition that you expect, it might be a sign that there's a mismatch somewhere between your data types or in the way you've written the query or something. For some reason, Postgres is not able to match it up as well as it thought. Index scans are quite fast if you're accessing a very small number of records, but compared to sequential scans of the same amount of data, they're actually much slower. It has to read the index as well as the sequential scan. It has to jump around a lot in the data and in the index itself. It also might have to read the same data multiple times, because it might have, for example, a record on block one of your table near the beginning of the index and then again near the end. And by that point, it may have left the cache and have to read in that block again. So you could actually end up doing not only slower I/O, but doing more I/O, more total blocks, than a sequential scan would have done. Never mind the fact that you also have to read the index. It does produce the records in a predictable order, which can allow the subsequent nodes, can allow the rest of the plan to be simpler, more efficient. Sequential scan, if the planner needed a particular order to do a join, for example, it would have to sort the results. But even a sequential scan plus a sort is often faster than scanning the whole index. There is a relatively new, though it's since I think 8.0 or even 7.4, type of scan in Postgres which can get you the best of both worlds. It's a little bit more complicated to follow, but basically what a bitmap index scan, and a bitmap index scan will be paired with a bitmap heap scan, can do is it can access the index, pull out all the records, the locations of the records that match your index criteria, then sort them on the physical location on disk, and fetch those blocks in sequential order, but only the blocks that have at least one record that's interesting. Now, even there, if you're accessing a significant percentage of the table, 20, 30%, that might mean every block. And so it wouldn't be worth going to the index in the first place anyways. But if you're accessing 5% of a, or even 1% of a very large table, this can make a huge impact because it allows you to access, 1% is still a lot of data, it can allows you to read it in sequentially, but only that 1%, not the whole table. So it gets you the best of both worlds of sequential I/O, but not having to read the whole table. But it does have to do a fair amount of work to do the work. It has to read all that data off the index, it has to sort it, it has to then is producing records that are not in the right order, so they might have to be sorted again afterwards. So it's not always going to be the best of both worlds, but it does get you a lot of the benefits of index scans without sacrificing a lot of the benefits of sequential scans. Bitmap index scans have another big advantage, which is that it allows you to combine multiple indexes. So if you have an index on, in this case it's the same index, but what it's doing in one scan is it's finding all the keys that are either key 2 or key 4, and then separately it's going to the index and finding 1, 3, and 5. Now, Postgres is not on this, it didn't notice that it's the same index and it can do this all in one scan, but there's a trade-off in how much work the planner is going to do to detect dumb queries, which is generally going to be a wasted effort. So you don't always put in checks for things like that. So it can pull out all the index pointers for 2 and 4, all the index pointers for 1, 3, and 5, and then either take those two sets and either form the disjunction or conjunction of them, either form the intersection or the union, just to be clear, of those two sets. And only then, once it's found the intersection or the union, go and retrieve the actual records that match all of the criteria. For some data warehousing systems, that can be a lifesaver because you can have many, many users, but be fetching the users between a certain age that fit the certain demographic you're looking for, that have participated in some program of yours. You can have several different criteria, and if you have those all in different columns, you don't want to have an index on every possible combination and order of those columns, but this allows you to have separate indexes. Use all of those indexes to narrow down the search, but only actually have to fetch from the heap the intersection, which might be a very small set. So you can have hundreds of thousands of each for each of these, but only have 10 users that match all of those criteria. That still has to do a fair amount of work on all of those indexes before it starts, so it's not going to be free. But the most expensive step is usually the heap scan, or at least one of the most expensive steps. So saving using all of the indexes to maximum advantage and combining them is one of the big advantages of bitmap heap scan. Again, this sometimes might be appropriate, but usually wouldn't be appropriate for an OLTP query because it has to do all of this work up front. OLTP queries, you're looking for queries that start immediately, have quick response time, and finish quickly. So you notice that the startup scan here is almost 6,000, in fact, is almost all of the scan. To produce the first record, it's estimated cost of 5,959, and the total cost for the whole query is 5,978. So almost all the work here is being spent up front before it produces even the first record. I think I'm going a bit slower. I'm trying to go in a bit less depth. There are a few other types of scans. These are fairly simple, to interpret. You can produce data by selecting from a function. Postgres supports something called values, which is actually instead of the keyword select. And sometimes you just select constants, and there isn't a table that you're selecting from. So Postgres has to be able to produce the data from those. One thing to realize is that functions in 8.3 are still, there's someone looking to fix that, but if you generate a lot of data from a function, Postgres has to save all that data in a temporary space. So it's not necessarily, unless it can inline it because it's plain SQL, but if it's a user-provided function, function scans that produce a lot of records might not be very memory efficient, CPU efficient. The other thing is that Postgres doesn't actually have much visibility into your functions to see how many records they're going to produce. So this will obviously produce 100 records. And that's generate series just produces the records 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. But Postgres is just taking a default estimate of 1,000 records. You can set on your function, new as of 8.3, you can set an estimate to use for that function, but it's just a constant. You can't say this will produce the difference between these two arguments or something like that. Okay, joins. The different types of joins have very different behaviors for runtime and how much IO, how much work they'll ask of their children of the join. Nested loops is probably the simplest to understand. It's basically how you would do it by hand if you were given two lists of data that were randomly ordered. You'd start going through the first one, and for each one of those, go through the second one and find all the matches. Then go to the second one, second record from the first child. Go to the second child and find all the matches for that. It's just what it sounds like. Nested loops. You're looping through the second the second child, looking for the results. In theory, nested loops are probably the slowest type of join. They require a lot of jumping around. They require a lot of work, especially from the second child. If you see a sequential scan on the second child of a nested loop, you have to realize it's going to be executing that sequential scan for every record of the first child. So unless that's a very small table, it's doubtful that that's what you really wanted. You'll almost always see an index scan there, unless, as I say, Postgres will recognize that if you have one record in your table, it's probably just faster to just read that one record. For OLTP systems, it's usually the one you want because it'll produce the first record very quickly. It'll be using index scans, find the two or three records that you're looking for, done, dusted. But for huge queries, it's actually very slow. It's the most flexible type of join. It can do joins even if the join clause is arbitrary inequalities. You can join where column A not equal to column B. It won't be using an index, but it can do it. You can even do cross joins where there's no join condition at all. So it'll start with the first record of the first one and go through the second table producing all of the combinations. The second record of the from the first child, go through the second child, produce output for all the combinations. That's another prime reason you might see a nested loop with two sequential scans, is because you forgot to put a join condition at all. Something to watch out for. When you're joining lots of data, Postgres will often try to use a merge join. That's because, in theory, merge joins are actually probably the most efficient type. And it's basically how you would join two lists if you had two sorted lists. If you sat down with two dictionaries and were told to find all the words that were missing from one or the other dictionary, you wouldn't look for the first word and then open up the second dictionary fresh for every word. You would just start from the first word and scan the two in parallel until you found one missing from one side or the other. And then you'd skip over that all the missing ones, noting them on the side, and continue along. It can only be used when you're joining based on something that looks like equality, and only if that equality belongs to a set of operators that defines an ordering, and if Postgres can produce the records in that ordering, either by sorting or using an index. Most data types satisfy those constraints. If you're using equality, all of the built-in data types have orderings defined for them. If you're using some exotic data type, you might have to check that it has defined what Postgres calls a B-tree ordering to make sure that if there's a B-tree ordering, then it's merge joinable. And you would need cross data type operators from that to something else if you're merge joining against a different data type. Sorry. It does require that both of its inputs be sorted. So if you're processing a lot of data, Postgres will often find that it's faster to use a sequential scan and then a sort on both sides and then do a merge join, rather than use your indexes to look up matching records. It'll look questionable, and if you know that it should be processing small amounts of data for your website or something, then either it has estimated the number of rows wrong, or something is preventing it from using your index, like maybe you forgot to make it. Merge join does, the startup time for merge join can be, well, especially because of the sorts, can be quite large. It can also be large even without sorts, because it's not going to produce a record until it finds a match on both sides. So if your two sets are quite disjoint, it might have to go through a lot of records on one side or the other before it finds a match. So it's another reason it isn't necessarily ideal for OLTP queries, that you want to have a quick response time for the first record. There's a type of join that kind of gives you the best of both worlds. It's not quite as much best of both worlds, but when you have one table that's, especially anyways, when you have one table that's quite small, it's appropriate because we can scan that one table quickly. In this case, it's doing a sequential scan of warehouse, not because there's no index on warehouse, but because there's only one row. So there's no point using an index to find that row. It's right there. So we scan that one row, stick it in a hash table, and then we do a sequential scan of the other table. So it's a little bit counterintuitive that it's actually going to do the hash first and then the sequential scan. And for each record in there, we just check if it's in the hash table. So that doesn't need, well, it could use an index here or an index there, not to do the join, but to find the restricted set of records needed. The hash itself doesn't depend on having something like an index to speed it up. It often is used with just plain old sequential scans. It's often used in cases like this where you have a lookup table and you're just looking up some information from one of them. It does have to take the startup, the time to build the hash before it can produce even the first record. So this time is bubbling up to there, and then in addition to that, that time gets added in before it can produce the last record. In this case, they're both quite small because there's only 10 records there and one record there, but the same principle would apply for larger queries. Similar to merge join, this can only be used if you're doing something like a quality and only if it if it's a hashable operator. Is that left? Right then. Set operations produce So partition scans have to scan all of their children. One thing to note is if you see a big sort above your setup, if you have a partition table or a union, rather, if you have a union query and you have a big sort above it, you might not notice the difference between union and union all. Union all says to produce the union of both tables in including all duplicates. Union actually has to remove the duplicates, which is something that catches up a lot of people. And if you're using partition tables and have constraints set up on your children, make sure you turn on constraint exclusion so that that previous query here, even though there's a clause that would exclude all those partitions, should produce a plan like that with many, obviously, fewer. There are two different kinds of sorts that Postgres can do. If you're sorting a large amount of data, it will overflow into an external disk sort. You can raise workmem so that it fits in memory. And when you, this will only be produced if you do explain analyze, because it's not something it's predicting. It's something it's finding when it actually runs it, that this one fit in memory and took this much memory, and so it could use a relatively efficient algorithm. This one had to go to disk, and the algorithm is efficient, but it does have to go into the file system cache and then read things back, and if it's large, dump them to disk. The limit clause produces a node limit. One thing to note here is that the estimated time and the actual time as well for the limit is quite quick. The plan underneath, because this asks for unordered records starting from the 10th going to the 20th, it just started a sequential scan and stopped when it reached 20 records. So the estimated cost is the cost for doing the whole sequential scan, even though in reality it knows that the limit won't do the whole sequential scan. So this is what I meant by an exception, where the cost didn't exactly bubble up. It took, it knew that the whole sequential scan would be 5,000, but stopping after 20 would be a cost of only one. On the other hand, this is a case where the time won't be proportional, because when it stops running, it stops running, and it doesn't know how long it would have taken to finish. So the time here is actually the actual amount of time spent scanning, which stopped early. The reason the startup cost is significant is because of the offset. So it actually, limit always has to produce all those records, even if you're telling it. So here I'm asking for records 10 through 20. It did have to produce the first 10 records and then throw them away. And then it produced the next 10 records and output them, and then it stopped. So if you're doing something like sort my entire table by a random ordering and then take just the first 10, that's not exactly analogous actually, but it would have to sort the entire table and produce all those records before the limit node throws them away. And sometimes Postgres never even executes a node in your plan. Zero, and it'll say never executed. And that can happen for a nested loop or a hash join like that. This is actually the end. Like I said, if you post to the list, people always ask for explain analyze. People often ask what version of Postgres you're using. These formulas and the options available change with each version. And sometimes people post queries that don't work on their version, and the answer is, it works much better in the next version. That will only happen, of course, in major releases, 8.3 versus 8.2. I would say any questions, but apparently there isn't really time.
If you had to do a BitMap scan, how efficient in memory is that? Like, for instance, if you have a table with a bazillion rows and you use an index to pick out like five of them, will it create a BitMap for the whole table, or will it just produce a BitMap for that section?
If one index produces five matches, it'll just produce the representation for those five matches.
So if you've got two indexes and they produce...
A million each, but five intersecting?
If they both produce five matches, then it's set and they happen to be identical, then it'll be very relevant.
Right.
But if they both produce a million...
And there's only five in the intersection. The answer to that is I'm not sure. Yeah, the bitmap representation itself is pretty dense. It's basically, I think, 4 bytes for each page. So there might be, plus the block ID. No, it's lossy. If you have too many tuples, it just starts remembering which blocks might have.
So it's not 1 bit per
block? It's 1 bit per block up to about 30 tuples. It's 1 bit per tuple up to about 32 tuples on the page. Oh, yeah. There's a small bitmap for each block, and there's a list of blocks.
So no, the memory doesn't wear linearly
The answer is this is a bit complicated. But yeah, it could consume...
bigger working helps in that it doesn't have to go lossy as fast. The lossiness isn't really that important because it's still going to need to do I.O. on the lossy.
So do you cripple your bitmap scans by having a very, very small work?
Yeah.
Is there a point at which it won't actually do a bitmap scan if it reckons it would be too big?
All of the nodes, all of the decisions, it tries to figure out how expensive it'll be. And if it works out to be more expensive than just a sequential scan or just a plain old index scan.
Would it decide not to do a bitmap scan if it becomes a bitmap or fits into a
The formula is...
Could you end up using more
I'm not sure about bitmap index scan, whether that's possible. There are some nodes. I had a slide earlier on hash aggregate. Yeah, hash aggregate is the one where it has to estimate whether it makes sense to hash a table or not. And if it makes the wrong decision, it can consume a lot of memory building a hash table. And actually, that's one query where if it makes the wrong decision, it could actually cause an error in your query. If you have... if you have a large table that Postgres thinks will be smaller, if you have a clause more likely that thinks will select only a few records and it actually selects millions of records and it's decided to use a hash table to do that, either for group by or for aggregates, that can actually cause an error if it's made a bad decision. Usually that doesn't happen. Hash joins are capable of spilling the hash to disk, which means it'll just run slowly if it made a bad decision. That's kind of true for all the decisions, but especially true for hash joins, I'd say. A few different places. Sometimes you'll see it on the second child of a nested loop because it's going to access that repeatedly. So if that's a subquery or some sort or something where it knows, well, it wouldn't be over a sort, but some subquery that's expensive to do, like some kind of join, then it's more efficient for it, once it's produced it once, to set it aside and then execute the nested loop against that saved materialized data. There's a few other places, I think, where it comes up as well. But generally, where it would be faster to have only executed the subplan once. Occasionally, you see it in places you wouldn't expect it, because it can be faster, even if it's done a sequential scan of your data, to set that aside and just use an almost identical copy than to use the original data. Because the version it sets aside is smaller and doesn't need to check transactions and several other things.
So, well, thank you much.